Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Labor Day is behind us and there are exactly 8 weeks until Election Day. Mail voting has already started in North Carolina, so it is officially crunch time for the campaigns. Last week, we questioned whether unrest in places like Kenosha and Portland would help President Trump electorally. We said there wasn't any evidence for that case, but there have been a lot of polls in the week since, many of which asked about Trump's law and order message. So we're going to check back in to see what they say. We're also going to discuss how many potentially competitive states there are this fall. The political map has been undergoing something of a realignment, with the Rust Belt becoming more Republican and the Sun Belt becoming more Democratic. So does that mean that more states are in play than have been in, say, the past couple decades? Here with me to discuss it all, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Good to see you, Galen.
So, exactly 8 weeks until Election Day. How are you guys feeling? Are you ready for the home stretch?
I feel unchanged.
I feel like I'm sleeping less well.
Looking forward to the election happening. We've been talking about this for so long, so I'm looking forward to it. You know, not sure how many voters are undecided either, honestly. So,
all right, amen. We got to make it through the next 8 weeks. But before we get to the topics that I mentioned, let's ask one of our favorite questions, and that's good use of polling or bad use of polling. And this example comes from a listener. So last week, The Atlantic used anonymous sources to report that President Trump disparaged Americans who died in war as, quote, losers and suckers. Before that report was published, though, Trump was trailing Biden in a Military Times poll of active duty service members by 4 points. And so the listener who sent us this question, Mark, asked whether that Military Times poll had a good methodology. He writes, quote, "When I read stories based on their polls in 2016, I assumed the Military Times polls were credible. But I had a conversation a few months ago with a coworker who served as the Clinton campaign's lead for veteran outreach in 2016, and he told me the methodology they used is garbage. He said they're just surveying their readers, which results in a sample that is neither random nor representative." So, as these reports have come out from The Atlantic, we've heard reporting on how veterans, how active duty service people feel about the president, the election. Folks have pointed to these Military Times polls as an example of Biden already doing better with service members than Trump was doing. So, Nate, are these polls reliable?
So, I think it's intrinsically pretty important to get a sense for what our service members think about politics. But the concerns that this reader raises are not entirely unfounded. In fact, if you look at the Military Times' write-up of their own poll, they put some somewhat important disclaimers. So I'll read from their article, right? "The poll, which has been administered in the same way for the past 4 years, is not a perfect snapshot of public opinion within the entire military force. The average age of poll respondents was nearly 39 years. And the participant pool was culled and verified from Military Times subscriber lists and databases. They said the poll is a, quote, a good sample of career-oriented military members' views, which may be different from the junior enlisted view of things." So there are a lot of pretty important caveats there. They are not drawing a random sample of active duty service members. Instead, it's people who they have on lists for the Military Times, and that can cause problems, right? Kind of the, you know, infamous poll from 1936 that showed Franklin Roosevelt losing to Alf Landon was polls conducted from lists, you wouldn't call them databases back then, but lists of magazine subscribers, right? And they also indicate a direction of the bias. It might be toward people that are more career-oriented, more interested in kind of more, I don't know, high-minded about the military rather than I'm going to put in my time and then do something else with my life, right? They're 39 years old. So that could create some biases toward more news consumer driven types of officers. You can imagine those officers are like a little bit more concerned with Trump's conduct if they're thinking institutionally about the military. B, in general, more news consuming, educated. I know these are all kind of loaded terms, right? But more educated voters, as measured by how many years you go to college, are more Democratic. With all that said, it does seem like the comparison apples to apples to 4 years ago should be pretty solid. And that shows a shift of opinion within the military away from President Trump.
Just briefly talk about the poll a little bit and why I'm nervous about this poll is that 82% of the respondents in the Military Times poll were white. About 57% of people in the military are white. Their respondents are about 93% male. About 84% of people in the military are male. So in some ways, this is not very representative of the actual military. It looks like their respondents are way more white and way more male than the military.
So, I mean, the question here more broadly is, how important is military support in this election? I think looking at the exit polls, veterans or active duty made up 13% of people who voted in 2016.
In terms of like military support, I mean, Harry Hinton, our former colleague, wrote a good piece for CNN.com kind of laying out why the veterans vote is important. And Trump won veterans about 60 to 30, according to the exit polls. He won them very overwhelmingly. I guess my one question would be active duty troops and veterans are very different groups. And I wonder on some level if a lot of the discussion about both the Atlantic piece and this military polling is really people trying to assess the white male vote and using this as a proxy for that. And the white male vote is very different from the military vote. And I would argue, my suspicion is, like, when I look at the police departments, for example, police officers who are black tend to vote for Democrats, and people who are white and male tend to vote for Republicans. And I wonder if the military's demographics predict their electoral preferences more than a group that is more male, particularly than the country, is likely to be more Republican leaning. So I wonder if we're looking at the military as a proxy for are white men breaking from Trump? And the answer to that question is generally no.
Well, but if the poll is too white and too male, then that might mean Trump's doing even worse if you sampled a random sample. So there are different biases here that might conflict. I mean, there is also this much bigger debate about how much is Trump losing ground among white voters. Some of the data, if taken at face value, would suggest that he is actually doing a little bit better with Hispanics and African-Americans and worse with white voters. That's kind of, if you look at the demographic crosstabs, and of course the crosstabs and polls can be small sample size and other issues, but it is interesting.
Well, he is doing kind of worse with some white demographic groups, right?
I mean, he has to be doing worse with somebody, right? Because he's losing by 7 or 8.
Right. So what is interesting, potentially, if, as Harry pointed out in his piece, the military has made up a certain base of support for Trump, that's bad news that he's losing it. But also the idea that Trump is losing old, like if we're talking about the veterans, which, as Perry points out, is a different demographic group, you see like, in general, people over 65 are saying Trump makes me feel less safe. So the idea that there's some movement because of Trump's maybe rhetoric, but also because of the fact that Biden has associated himself with the military because his family served, because, you know, on and on and on.
Yeah, I mean, even if we're comparing apples to apples here of the Military Times poll from 2016 to the Military Times poll in 2020, and so roughly the same demographic groups, in 2016, Trump was leading amongst this group by 20 points. In 2020, Biden is leading amongst this group by 4 points. So even if the poll itself has certain biases, you would assume the biases would be the same both years. So something is changing. And maybe you've hit on it in terms of white people are shifting more towards Biden. Or does it seem like there could be something specific to the military because of Trump's relationship to the military over the past 4 years?
It's hard to say, right? Like, I think sometimes these controversies, like I was reading the Jeff Goldberg piece in The Atlantic that we are all talking about that is, you know, anonymously sourced from, you know, 4-star generals who say Trump said these bad things about veterans, about amputees, you know, bad stuff, right? I do wonder how much the Twitter controversy is trickling down. I say this as an open question. I'm not sure how much some of these, like, Trump speaks ill of the dead outside of the John McCain thing, which I think really did reach the broader population. I'm not sure how much these little, you know, instances of Trump saying something incredibly insensitive are percolating down. And if you assume, like, you know, maybe people in the military are making political switches away from Trump for different reasons, or for a broad host of reasons, not specifically because of his remarks.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a little apples to oranges to try to tie the Atlantic article in with kind of what rank and duty troops feel. You know, I would think someone who, again, joins the military is someone who's pretty thoughtful about the role that institutions play in the country, including the military itself. And if you're someone who's thoughtful about institutions and kind of law and order, kind of not in an all caps case like Trump would use it, but kind of in a lowercase version of that, then you could see Trump's lack of respect for institutions as being problematic in a way that someone who hadn't taken, because like, it's not like the military, being in the military, just some demographic checkbox, right? You know, if you decide to join the military, that's a very profound life choice. And you can imagine that conditions all types of views on political affairs, on the presidency and everything else, right? And if you feel like he has an unsteady hand, then maybe you are concerned about that. But again, you know, I wish we had like more data. I mean, I think the average 23-year-old serviceman would be more concerned about that kind of thing and not about like the Atlantic article, particularly with the fact that the article is sourced confidentially. You know, my bias is to think that like when sources are anonymous or confidential, those don't quite mean the same thing, by the way, that it tends not to penetrate beyond kind of elites.
Yeah, Perry, I know you've written about when to trust anonymous sources, which have been a common way of reporting things during the Trump presidency. What are some guidelines there?
I tend to think that when incidents are described very specifically, I mean, first of all, The Atlantic is a credible publication in the way that I would say the New York Times or the Washington Post are. They're not like making up things at random. Jeff Goldberg is a reporter who's covered a lot of these national security issues for a long time. So I tend to be not that skeptical that he got something right. Also that the incidents that they were described were fairly specific, and that tends to make me think that they are true, because you know it's harder to sort of make up some detail. Those details seem fairly precise, and even though they were denied, I'm skeptical they were like made up out of whole cloth for that reason. I guess the other thing about the story is he insulted John McCain in public. Like, the conduct described was not particularly... He insults all kinds of people. We know he and General Kelly had a bad relationship because Kelly and him were feuding in public at times. We know him and Mattis had a bad relationship because they were feuding in public. There's been a lot of generals who serve in the administration who've been pushed out or quit in protests or what have you. So the Atlantic article in some ways was like... The actual quotes were sort of a vicious version of what Trump says in public, but nothing that was there was that surprising.
I mean, first of all, at 538, so you can be assured we're not being super hypocritical. We're pretty conservative about using anonymous sources, I think more so than most newsrooms. I'd also say I think a lot of newsrooms have an official policy about anonymous sources and then enforce it pretty laxly. Yeah, look, I mean, I was looking for polling on this weekend about how do Americans feel about anonymous sourcing. The only poll I could find was a Rasmussen Reports poll, and I don't really think Rasmussen Reports is a very great pollster, but that poll did find that like people tend to be inclined not to trust anonymous sourcing. So when the president says, oh, this stuff is just made up, I would imagine a lot of people are inclined to be sympathetic to that, especially because a lot of people are not hugely trusting of the media in general. So I have no reason to think that, I mean, I think Jeffrey Goldberg, you know, The Atlantic has done great work, by the way, on lots of issues, including coronavirus lately, right? I would not think he'd be the type to, you know, do anything untoward at all. I do think, though, that like the average American who doesn't live kind of on Twitter or in journalism land, you know, I think they would see Trump's pushback against anonymous sources as not being a straw man, but as being actually maybe fairly persuasive.
All right, so we're talking about anonymous sources. This started with a good use or bad use of polling example from the Military Times. Ultimately, Nate, good use or bad use of polling?
Ooh, I'm on the fence here. I guess I'll say good use because I just think that, like, you know, active duty troops are a group that play a vital role and we hear very little from. So any effort to capture their views, I think, is important. I wish this poll, though, read about the Literary Digest poll and the perils of using lists of magazine subscribers instead of trying to find some way to get a random sample.
Perry, Claire, good use, bad use?
I think the sample was so different than the actual military. I think it's a bad use, to be honest with you. I think you have to get a better sample or just not do it.
I guess I'd go with bad use. I think they should have maybe signaled up top that it's a specific group of people.
Exactly. That too. The transparency was lacking. You had to really read carefully to figure out who the sample was and how it was different than the actual military.
Yeah. And just to leave this here, Perry, you mentioned our former colleague, Harry Enten, had written about this. I mean, the stakes are significant, as Harry writes. To paraphrase, he said, in 2016, Trump won veterans and active military members by a 27-point margin over Clinton. And then goes on to say that they make up about 13% of the electorate, which is more than there are Hispanic voters and just a little bit less than there are 18 to 29-year-olds. Of course, both of those groups also make up part of the military. Harry goes on to say that Trump won the 6 close swing states of Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by less than 4 points each. Trump lost among those who were not active or veteran voters in each of those 6 states. In other words, Trump would not be president right now if it were not for the military vote. In Florida, for example, Trump would have been defeated by a little less than 5 points without military voters. He actually won the state by 1 point. So, suffice it to say that, you know, we don't have enough data given that this poll is not completely reliable. But as you can see from how adamantly Trump is responding to this and also the money that the Biden campaign has put into ads messaging on this, that this seems somewhat high stakes for the election.
I mean, are we sure the stakes are high because it's about the veterans vote? Like, I thought the stakes were high because I think that non-veterans might care, or non-people in the military might care. If this story is true, then I guess I didn't necessarily see it totally as a Trump is responding because the military vote is so important. I actually think Trump is responding because, like, swing voters, this got a lot of news attention last. This was not like a random story. It sort of took away from Trump's focus on law and order and put it back on an issue where is it, Trump is mean. Trump is running as the law and order guy. So if the military hates him, that would sort of contradict that message. The way this played out the last 5 days, I wonder if Trump's in defensive, not just because of veterans, but also because it might be percolating down to regular voters because it's getting covered so much in part.
Yeah. I think that's totally fair. And we'll see, I guess, in future polls if this is a question that gets asked and whether, of course, voters beyond the military say that they care. But let's move on and follow up on our conversation about Trump's law and order message from last week. But first,
today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze. Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Shopify.com/538.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We said last week that the press was getting ahead of itself in characterizing the unrest in Kenosha and Portland as potentially advantageous to the president. So I wanted to come back to this conversation with another week of data under our belts. We got the results of a lot of polls last week, many of which asked about the unrest and Trump's law and order message. So, Perry, what does the evidence show?
The Jacob Blake shooting was on August 23rd. And according to our polling average, Biden was ahead by 9.2. And according to our polling average right now, Biden's ahead by 7.5. So there has been a little bit of a shift to Trump. It's not a huge shift. And it's also notable, of course, the Republican National Convention happened in that time. So that could be a shift based on that. What you're seeing in the polls is when people are asked questions around, who do you think is better in terms of like keeping America united or keeping it safe or about race relations? Almost all these questions, Biden comes out better than Trump. So it doesn't appear that the law and order message is really resonating where people think Trump is better on these issues than Biden. So in that sense, it doesn't appear to be resonating. And if you look at the swing state polls, Biden generally leads in those in similar margins to before. So this idea that I think the idea was that once there was a focus on the riots and law and order, that you see this big swing in swing states among white voters from Biden to Trump. And you just haven't seen a big swing. If nothing else, I'd say the race is pretty similar to where it was before this whole debate started.
Claire, we saw, both after we recorded our podcast last Monday, both Biden and Trump respond to this and spend a decent part of the week addressing the unrest. What were those responses like? Like, how have the two candidates, regardless of what the polling that we're looking at says, how are the candidates managing the issue?
Well, Joe Biden has made, his campaign has sort of been famous for being in one place mostly, and he made a trip to visit the family of Jacob Blake. And so that was a big deal, right? That was I think the fact that the family is willing to meet with Joe Biden says a lot, right? So he sort of addressed it head on, I think sees it as both a thing that he needs to address and I think wants to address. And I think Biden wants to sort of say, this is something that's happening right now. This is going on. This is a person that I want to focus on. Trump, I think, has been status quo norm for what Trump's reaction to protests and racial unrest has been for the duration of the summer. And as we saw from a couple of polls that came out, I was most surprised, frankly, by, I think I mentioned this in the last segment, but the reactions of older people and I think most racial demographic groups except for white men seem to respond in some polls that Trump made them feel less safe, which seems significant, I think. Nate, I think you were looking at some of those numbers last week too, right? And tweeting about them.
Yeah, first of all, from the top line numbers, I think I'm a little bit more emphatic in thinking that this has kind of been a flop for Trump in the polls. So right now the margin is 7.5 points. And as Perry said, it was like 9.2 or 9.3 before the RNC, which reflected in part, in theory, Biden's convention bounce. That's like kind of a below average convention bounce for Trump to swing from the so-called peak of Biden's bounce to his bounce. And if anything, you can actually see something where like Trump has actually lost a tiny bit of ground since his convention, where he got the race down to -7 and now it's 7.5 again. I know I'm like kind of looking at very minor things here, right? But you could say that Trump had a convention message that was a little muddled, but included somewhat more positive notes. There was like a little bit more outreach to minorities and moderate Republicans. Again, inconsistent messaging, right? But the convention tried to paint a better light on where the economy is headed, kind of a very glossy light on coronavirus, right? And then he pivots to this law and order message. And number one, his standing in national polls has gotten a bit worse, maybe. Number two, there have been a lot of polls of Wisconsin in particular, and Trump is polling pretty badly in Wisconsin. He's down like 7.5 in Wisconsin as well. And his lead seems to be, or Biden's lead seems to be growing there, if anything. And number three, all types of other results, kind of asking people directly, how do you feel about who makes you safe? And the answer is overwhelmingly that Biden makes people feel safer, except among white working class voters, right? White non-college voters say, yes, Trump makes me feel safer. He's the advantage on that issue. Every other group of voters, though, kind of runs away from Trump. And so it's kind of winds up being like a base maximization strategy. When we've said this so many times in different ways, we don't think the base is enough for Trump to win the election, especially when you kind of really repel suburban, moderate, independent voters with this stuff, right? When you repel moderate Hispanics with this messaging. So I don't know. I think it's been a failure for Trump.
One question I have here. We mentioned last week that even if the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement have become less popular over the past several months, voters in their minds haven't linked that to Joe Biden and thought, therefore, I prefer Joe Biden less than I used to. So the question I have, though, because we've gotten more polling about this over the past week, we saw a Yahoo News poll showing that the majority of Americans think the protests have gone too far. Of course, opposition to Black Lives Matter has continued to rise. It's about equal portions of Americans who now say that the protests are mostly peaceful and who say that the protests are mostly violent. So my question is, kind of regardless of whether or not this weighs on the race and affects Biden's standing, does it affect how effective the movement can be if there is a potential Democratic administration in the White House?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I guess the first thing would be movements are not necessarily doing their polling every day, you know, to figure out are we popular or not. Like, you know, I think I said this last week, when people say defund the police, they're not clueless. They probably know that's not the most popular thing in the world. So I don't know that Black Lives the movement itself would be less effective in a, I think the movement's goals will be effective when they're popular and not when they're not popular. I think that might be the way to think about it. Is like Joe Biden seems fairly focused on what does the median voter think about a lot of things. And I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are fairly aware the median voters not for defunding the police, but they might be for banning chokeholds. And I think, or like limiting tear gas. Or I think that there's probably there's a lot of polling around police reform ideas. And my sense is the movement will be more successful when it pushes ideas that are more popular, and it'll be less effective when they're pushing ideas that are more unpopular. But that's it. I think the movement is also involved in, I hate the phrase Overton window, but they definitely are involved in a lot of like, here's an extremely unpopular idea that we want to get on the radar screen. And I also think the movement's trying to get like, are you going to get the police abolished? I mean, Joe Biden's not in charge of the police in the first place. Police forces are local. So Joe Biden being for or against defunding the police is a bit of a theoretical issue. And I do think in some of these cities, like Minneapolis, like Austin, you are seeing more support for like reducing funding for police, because the median voter in Austin or Minneapolis is way to the left of the median voter in America who Joe Biden's trying to appeal to.
I mean, there's this kind of implicit framing, which I think kind of, Galen, you even used in your question a bit, right? Which is like, makes it seem like this is some opportunity for Trump to turn opinion against the protest, or it might not work, right? But I guess I'm saying kind of it might be the opposite, that like Trump is a reason that these protests are popular, or at least they're somewhat popular, and why they're kind of one reason why they're well attended. You know, I think they might look different in a myriad of ways under a Joe Biden presidency. I mean, especially kind of early on in the protests, where like there were about police brutality, they were about racism, right? But they're also kind of broad, like anti-Trump protests.
I think Nate is getting it. I don't know if Nate is saying this exactly, but I do think my sense is the movement, if Biden is president, the movement will not be able to sort of position itself against Trump, and the movement may pursue even more aggressive ideas. So I sort of think they might. I'm doubting the Black Lives Matter movement will ever get to like 70% popularity, because I think they're always going to try to pursue ideas that are somewhat unpopular. Like, my guess is they'd move to reparations. If the police were defunded in some places, they'd move to reparations, which is also unpopular. So, and they try to, because I think they're engaged in trying to change public opinion as opposed to like reacting to the existing public opinion.
All right. Well, I'm glad we could follow up on some of the questions that we posed last week with the data that we've gotten since. But as I mentioned earlier, I do want to talk about the breadth of the 2020 electoral map. So as we enter this home stretch of the 2020 campaign in the coming weeks, we're going to be talking about the political dynamics of particular states that are in play this year. But I think we can kick this off with maybe just talking about more broadly how many competitive states there potentially are. So in 2016, with Trump's success in the blue wall states that had gone Democratic for decades, it became clear that the map was changing in some ways. And then likewise, Democrats picked up many House seats in traditionally Republican suburbs across the Sun Belt in 2018, you know, suggesting that we could be in the midst of a realignment here. So, Claire, Is it safe to say that in 2020, the number of states potentially in play is broader than we've seen in decades?
I think it's safe to say that you can see more creative electoral maps, that people can think maybe about different states, and they wouldn't serve themselves well to only see, you know, three different scenarios based on the past, whatever, seven elections. That there's a lot more potential for, I guess, capricious electoral maps. You know, I often think about whether or not also this map and its sort of creativity is Trump specific too, in part because I'm always curious about what the, you know, the John Kasich Republicans who vote for Biden will do once, you know, let's say hypothetically a President Biden were elected and 4 years later they had a more normal Republican nominee. You know, maybe some states or areas would snap back to a more, you know, a pre-Trump reality. But the idea that Florida can be both a somewhat of a bellwether the past few presidential elections, but then kind of confound people in 2018 by being a lot more red than people thought it was. You know, is that a Trump-specific phenomenon? Who knows? But also the idea that a lot of states that, let's say, Clinton's campaign in 2016 thought looked pretty ripe for her and didn't end up, you know, going blue, well, maybe there's more of a shot this year. So I do think that it's just a bit more of like, there are a lot more question marks, I think. And I also think people are probably a little bit, maybe people are going to be a little less sure of their predictions of which way a state will go. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think there'll be a lot of hedging about, you know, what way a state may or may not break in 2020.
Yeah, jump in here. What do y'all make of this in terms of, are there just more states that are at least potentially competitive?
No. I mean, I think your statement is...
Go for it,
Nate. Smartass. The problem with your statement is that in decades part, right? That's flatly wrong.
Okay, a decade and a half? I don't mean Clinton's election. I guess I mean Bush, Bush, Obama, Obama, Trump.
Probably also wrong. So
all right, give it to me, Nate. Teach me a lesson.
Bill Scher, S-C-H-E-R, who writes for Politico, Real Clear Politics, and other places, actually posted some data this morning. How many states did you wind up with a margin within 5 points? In 2000, it was 12. 2004 was 11. 2008 was 6. 2012 was 4. 2016 was 10. If you look based on the 538 polling averages today, then I think it's 8. If you look based on our forecasted margin, which is slightly different, I think it winds up being like 9 or something. A lot of states are pretty close. So it's not that out of the ordinary. Instead, what was out of the ordinary was how few competitive states there were in 2008 and 2012. By historic standards, more states are still blowouts than there used to be in the 90s or the 60s or whatever else. And I think people kind of got used to these very unusual maps, like in 2012, where like it just so happened that like there were hardly any swing states. But that was the outlier. It's not like, I mean, it's normal to be talking about like a half dozen to a dozen states. Also, like the number of states that are competitive or interesting is broader than the number of states that will actually wind up being close, right?
So maybe let's talk a little bit more about the specific ways that the map is changing from those 2008-2012 style elections. But first, Perry, where is the map becoming more competitive for Democrats and more competitive for Republicans?
So I think part of it is like, if you look at the polls right now, when Biden's ahead by so much nationally, that does put more states in play. So to me, I didn't expect 4 years ago that the Democratic candidate would have a good chance of winning Ohio and Iowa. Maybe I was wrong to think that. But Biden is doing better in Ohio and Iowa. He's basically tied a lot of these polls in both those states. I thought those states were going to be more Republican than they are, I guess. I thought maybe they'd be out of reach for any Democratic candidate, or they would be the clear underdog in them. I'm not sure they are. I guess Texas, Georgia, Arizona, I'm not sure I would have said I expected them to be as close as they are in 4 years ago at this date as they are now. So those states, again, I think they're close in part because Biden is doing so well nationally. I'm not totally sure. Like, I'm watching the polls in Minnesota because I think that is a state this may be. But it looks like Minnesota, the Republicans have gotten 45 in 2000, 47 in 2004, 44 in 2008, 45 in 2012, 45 in 2016. So part of 2016 in Minnesota was that Clinton did particularly poorly, and there was a fairly large third party vote in Minnesota in 2016. So I don't know if the Republican number of Minnesota is going up, or if the or if Biden will win by 5 points there. I don't have a good sense of that. But I think overall, like, the map to me looks more interesting, in part because it looks like Biden is competitive in a lot of places and maybe can win this kind of 08 style. Like, remember in 08, Obama won Indiana, which was not competitive 4 years later. And he lost by a substantial margin in Indiana 4 years later. So I feel like part of what's going on here is, I'm not sure there's a ton of states that Trump is putting on the map, but right now there's a lot of states that I think the combination of Biden being more popular than the average Democrat, maybe, and Trump being less popular than the average Republican. I think there's a, in other words, look, there's a lot of states in play, but that's mainly because Biden can win them, as opposed to it being like a lot of states in play that Trump is going to win. Maybe I'll be proven to be wrong about this in a few weeks, but that's what it looks like to me, is the map is big because Biden can win a lot of states.
Which was the entire point of the Democratic primary, ultimately, right, was that they wanted someone who was quote-unquote electable, which we talked ad nauseum about was largely seemed to be an appeal to these upper Midwest traditional blue wall states where the Democrats had lost white voters. So Biden has like the white voter touch, I think.
How much, you brought this up a little bit, Claire, in your first answer. How much of this is Biden-Trump specific, and how much of this is underlying changes in the American electorate that maybe predate them and could possibly post-date them?
I mean, the annoying answer is it's all of the above. I think there are lots of trends that were already happening in American electoral preference that Barack Obama accelerated, that perhaps Trump accelerated or brought to the surface. I mean, you know, as far as whether or not this is specific to a Biden-Trump candidacy, like, my example is always Ohio because I'm from there and because I've done a lot of reporting there. And I wrote a piece in 2018 where people kept on saying to me, the state will stay red if the nominee is someone super liberal, but the name Biden specifically came up over and over as the kind of person who could win these white pockets that had flipped from Obama to Trump. So, you know, I do think that there is something to be said for Bill Clinton could win sort of more of the traditional South, but Al Gore, who's from Tennessee, couldn't swing it in 2000. And that was, a lot of that had to do with, like, people thought Gore was like a, just a DC guy, right? Just an elite guy. So a lot of this stuff is candidate specific. Like, you pick a person, a specific person, for a reason. But there are a lot of trends, like the demographic trends in Georgia and Arizona are just a reality, right? That changes the electoral map, and it will continue to in the future. But I do think a lot of it is potentially candidate specific, which is why I think this year's map could potentially be really interesting.
Keep in mind, there are also states that have kind of graduated out of being competitive, where Colorado is no longer really all that competitive, and Virginia, New Mexico probably is no longer competitive. You know, states like Oregon were once competitive. They aren't anymore. On the other side, you know, Missouri was once competitive. Although there was a poll in Missouri today that came out that showed it within 5 points. But in general, Missouri is suffering from not being as competitive anymore. So I don't know any better way to do it than just do like an apples-to-apples comparison of, like, you know, how many states are polling closely now versus how many states wound up being close in previous elections.
The other question in here is maybe not the number of states that are potentially competitive, but which states are potentially competitive. And so does it seem like we're headed into a future where Republicans are reliably winning, you know, the upper Midwestern states, and adding to Trump's victories, places like New Hampshire and Minnesota, maybe even Maine, while Democrats are winning places like Georgia, Arizona, even Texas? Does it seem like that's what the future looks like? Or is it way too early to say?
I think it's too early to say. You know, I write about demographics and so on a lot, but I'm hesitant to say, like, I did a piece today looking at, like, white college-educated voters are a demographic group we talk about a lot, but white college-educated voters in Georgia and Texas are way more Republican than they are in Iowa, and the ones in Maine are less Republican than even Iowa or Georgia. So I'm hesitant to think, and it looks like There's a lot of different things when you look at the crosstabs of these polls. Some of the crosstabs suggest the sort of college, non-college gap is growing. And some of them suggest it's not. We're like, it's like Biden has kind of lowered the non-college white gap, but that the college gap has not grown as much as you would maybe expect. So I think that Biden is doing really much better than Hillary in some suburbs, but not all suburbs. So I'll be curious when we look at the exit polls and the geography from like Wisconsin and Minnesota, if this sort of like polarization along sort of college degrees or income or culture or class that we've been talking about, I'm actually not sure that that's going to keep growing or if that stays the same, because I think part of that is a Trump effect. And I'm not sure if you have a Republican who's more culturally liberal, for lack of a better way to say that, I wonder if that person does better in the suburbs. And if you look at like the data from Texas or Florida, even, it looks like there are a lot of Latino voters in those states, but they're not becoming that much more Democratic. Like, it looks to me, if you look at Texas, particularly in Arizona, even, I'm not sure that what's changing the electorate is that the more Latino voters or more college-educated voters in the electorate. It's more that the college-educated whites in those states don't seem to like Trump as much as Mitt Romney, but that might change if, like, Marco Rubio is a candidate in 2024. I think we should be cautious about taking the demographic trends. I don't think we're going to wake up in 2024 and Trump and the Republicans have won the Midwest and the Democrats have won the Sun Belt. I think it's going to be more complicated than that.
I think that the Hispanic vote is the most interesting because, you know, I think Republicans have lost Black voters because of a bad history with them. And Hispanic voters, they're in the states that are important electorally. They're growing populations. And I think like the outreach that's done by the parties over the next 10 or 20 years will be really interesting because I think you do have a lot of, let's say, young, you know, there's a lot of talk by like Latino outreach groups about people aging into voting or aging into citizenship, stuff like that. Like, it's really important to catch that first wave of this is my first vote and this is the party that my family associates with. And if, you know, I think Republicans do, I think, or will find themselves a little bit damaged by the fact that he's had such an aggressive, often terrible headlines making immigration policy. So like that puts, I think, Republicans on the back, you know, a little bit back on recruiting Hispanics. But yeah, when you look at crosstabs, which has come up a lot today, it is interesting how open I think a lot of Hispanic voters are to voting for Republicans, including Trump.
Yeah, I think I agree with all of you. I think people on average overestimate trends and underestimate mean reversion. You probably heard me say that before. It's kind of a very boring way to put it, right? But like, you know, look at a state like North Carolina, right? Was thought to be going, oh, Obama won it in 2008 and North Carolina is going to become really blue now, or at least perpetually competitive. And it's kind of remained like a bit red-leaning relative to the rest of the country, unlike Virginia or Colorado, for example. Hell, Obama won Indiana in 2008, which is a huge fluke that people forget about, and that quickly reverted back to being kind of very Republican in elections thereafter. So yeah, I mean, look, particularly if Republicans lose this election, then what's going to be then? It'd be 7 out of 8 they lost in the popular vote. If they lose the presidency, they'll probably also still be out of power in the House and probably the Senate, right, after having had a bad midterm. So they might change strategies, right? I mean, one reason why these trends aren't sustained is because parties say, oh, it turns out that Trumpism is losing electorally, and so let's do something different. So yeah, I think it's a little bit foolish to kind of extrapolate outward. You know, with that said, clearly states where you have a lot of generational turnover, it's important. You know, the average kind of 23-year-old in Texas probably votes differently than the average 77-year-old, and that 77-year-old is more likely to age out of the electorate, quote unquote, at some point. So that could be relevant potentially, but that's fairly glacial. And again, you know, maybe Trump is doing better among Hispanics this year. That could be a whole other segment that we have potentially. You know, as people get kind of integrated in their communities, immigrant groups can change their views. So it's always a little bit more dynamic than people assume, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was looking at this verified voter survey from Pew, and essentially today, white voters make up more than 70%, around 73% of the electorate. And in 2036, they'll still make up about 65% of the electorate. Like, the demographics actually change maybe a point or two from one election to the next. But like, it's the swings, as you were saying, Perry, that can make a much bigger difference than actual demographic change. If, you know, just entertain me for one second. If we did see the current trends continue, where over a matter of years, Democrats start to do better in the Sun Belt more reliably, and Republicans do better in the Rust Belt more reliably, does that advantage one of the parties electorally, or is that like about a fair swap?
So what disadvantaged Democrats is kind of that they get neither benefit in like the exact kind of Hillary Clinton configuration, where she lost enough ground in the upper Midwest to lose several of those states and then gain ground in the Sun Belt, but not enough to win any of those states, right? It was kind of like the worst possible combination for Democrats. It's unlikely that they're going to maintain exactly in that, if you imagine like a kind of U-shaped, right, where either you're starting the upper Midwest or the Sun Belt and you kind of get stuck in between. You know, they'll probably move out of that bottom of that U at some point, one direction or another. In particular, when Texas gets close to the tipping point, that becomes more problematic for Republicans than other states with fewer electoral votes, right? Arizona clearly is near the tipping point now. It's only 11 electoral votes, so it doesn't matter quite as much. But again, you know, I have spent a lot of time trying to tease out, how do you predict what the vote's going to be in this state based on just past results, right? And you actually don't really gain anything by looking at the long-term trajectory. You look at saying, okay, look at the last two elections, and you assume it's going to be some average of the last two elections, and then beyond that doesn't really add much predictive power, and you're kind of foolish to see patterns. You know, look, there are also issues related to like population density. The states in the South are actually pretty urban and dense, and they're getting more urban and more dense. That might be a reason to expect Democratic vote share to grow there, because it's correlated now with urbanization and density.
All right, I want to leave things with maybe a more fun question, which is, we're all going to be paying a lot of attention to this map over the next 8 weeks. What state are each of you like most interested in tracking as we head into Election Day in terms of how things shake out?
Florida.
Yeah.
Why Florida?
Because Florida is such a weird state, because it's now the official residence of the president, which maybe there's something going on there, because Florida swings in ways that are kind of unpredictable sometimes, because Florida has a Hispanic population that is more historically Republican, because Florida has a lot of old people who don't seem to be liking Trump very much right now. I don't know. What are other Florida reasons? Nate, were you the one who agreed?
Yeah, I mean, because Florida is a state where, like, in kind of the emerging Democratic majority hypothesis, right, like Florida is pretty, it's coastal, it's dense, it's very mixed racially, it's urban. You would think that like Florida would be a state that would become bluer, and it kind of has resisted that so far. And in the short run, that's probably more important than Texas as far as why this current map has not been helpful to Democrats in the Electoral College. You know, if you can imagine that Florida was like a little bit bluer than the tipping point, and now Biden is solid in Florida, now just has to not kind of blow it in like Minnesota or something. I mean, that's a lot easier given Florida has so many electoral votes. And so Florida is kind of fascinating to watch. And like you said, Claire, it's also weird. You know, there are definitely maps in which, I mean, at this point, Biden has to lose ground to lose the election, right? Let's say Biden loses ground in the Midwest and Florida saves him somehow, right? Or maybe Texas moves one direction and Florida doesn't. Florida's just weird. If you're from Florida, we think that your state is weird. We want to let you know that.
Perry, what about you?
I'm going to give three states. I think Pennsylvania is interesting in that I think it's a state that if Trump wins, it's hard for me. I assume he has to win Pennsylvania to win the election. And also it's interesting in this story we've been telling the last 4 years about, you know, like rural areas, smaller towns are moving toward Republicans. Pennsylvania, that happened in 16. Suburbs in 18 in Pennsylvania moved very much away from Trump. So I want to see, or the Republicans. So I want to see Pennsylvania electorally. And then obviously on election night, if Biden is winning the way we think he is, or he's winning the way his polls right now suggest. Obviously, like, the Democrats winning Georgia or Texas would be a hugely interesting story. So I'm just going to keep reading those polls there. I sort of assume Trump will win those states at the end of the day. But I think, like, 18, watching Georgia and Texas are kind of fascinating to see if those states are won by a Democrat, because they basically never are.
All right. Well, interesting states to watch, and we'll definitely be covering the trends in those states specifically over the next 2 months, but let's leave it there for now. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.